Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. The First Amendment to the U.S. Constitution has been a source of endless debate for the last 200 years or so. From Christmas trees in state capitals to cases in the U.S. Supreme Court, the separation of church and state has been one of the mainstays of American government. But in the 21st century, American politics have been increasingly influenced by a faction called the Christian Right. What is it, and what are its goals? I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air. With me is Dan Hummel, author of Covenant Brothers, Evangelicals, Jews, and U.S.-Israeli Relations. Also, he's a research fellow at the UW-Madison, and welcome back to University of the Air.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
This whole business of separating church and state, I guess, has been difficult from the get-go because, after all, if you're looking at European settlement in America, some of the most influential, most famous, the ones writing the history, in many cases, were those pilgrims who definitely had a religious theme to their very being in America. And there is a long tradition, is there not, of those Christian values being entangled with American way of government.
Yes, this is one of the core challenges of the American experiment, you could say, is this church and state relationship. And even those Puritans, you know, they were, by our accounts, theocratic, you could say. When they set up their colonies here in North America, there was very little separation between church and state. And yet they were fleeing the situation in Great Britain, where they were the dissenters. They were kicked out of their pulpits and marginalized in their society because they weren't following the state church in England. And so it's already complicated with the Puritans. And that theme of where does the line between the church and state go is something that we see all through American history. We see it in the abolition movement. We see it in prohibition. These are just some of the social issues that have caused a lot of Christians in particular to get active in politics and use arguments rooted in their faith to argue for political change. And so you can think of the Christian right today, at least in one way, as a continuation of that story. There are things that are new about it or different than previous movements, but in another way, they are as American as anything else.
Well, let's define that term right when we say Christian right.
Yes. So the Christian right, so one way to think about that is on the American political spectrum, the right is considered conservative. And so we're talking about Christians who, for various reasons, have positioned themselves on the conservative side of American politics. Often that's been through the Republican Party, which has been seen for a long time as the conservative party. But sometimes people on the Christian right are more radical than the Republican Party. And so they've actually critiqued Republicans from the right, from further right. The Christian right, as we're talking about today, emerged mostly in the 1970s and is still with us. But there's a good history of a longer tradition of the Christian right that at least goes back to the 1930s and reactions against the New Deal by fundamentalists and by other Christian right type figures. And they come and go through the middle of the 20th century and then sort of flow into the Christian right as we talk about today. But there is a longer history than just the 1970s to the present, even when we talk about the Christian right.
What would have been their opposition to the New Deal? I mean, wasn't it essentially just a way to get the country out of the Great Depression?
Well, that was how it was pitched, certainly by FDR. The Christian right has often, like many conservatives, been suspicious of any growth of the federal government. And the New Deal was groundbreaking at the time for bringing in a lot more government programs and a lot more centralization of power into the federal government. You can think about this also. I mean, there were all types of reasons why Christians in the 1930s didn't like the New Deal. But there was also a concern in the South, where many Christians were located, of how this federal government role would play with issues relating to race and how a stronger federal government that might be captured by Northern interests would force things on the South. This wasn't all Christian right leaders, but there was certainly a faction of the Christian right that merged their Christianity with their concern for keeping Jim Crow laws in the South and were so suspicious of the New Deal and then the growth of the federal government after that on those terms alone.
They were concerned that the federal government would be imposing some kind of race-mixing policies on them.
Right, or just desegregation policies in general. This is something that FDR had made, at least rhetorically, part of his desire, though he ended up ultimately having to often settle with Jim Crow Southern Democrats to get what he wanted done. But, you know, Harry Truman desegregated the military, and then further on, Lyndon Johnson and others. The Democratic Party became known, ultimately, for its desire to get rid of segregation, even though at the time many of the Christian right, the old Christian right, as we might call it, in the South was also Democratic. So it was sort of an intra-party squabble at that time.
And it's almost funny hearing you talk about the Republican Party being the one that is more interested in maintaining this tradition. Mm-hmm. Whereas, didn't things just flip in about 1964 with Barry Goldwater? I mean, we think now the Republicans being very conservative and Democrats being progressive or liberal. But
yes, this is one of the things that historians of 20th century politics talk a lot about is how it can be misleading just to project back the current policies of the Republican and Democratic Party past basically about 50 or 60 years ago because things do get scrambled. Think about African Americans, for an example. So African Americans had a love of the Republican Party coming out of the Civil War because that was the party of Lincoln. That was the party that seemingly fought for their freedom. And there was some loyalty to that actually up until the New Deal, where the New Deal really benefited African Americans almost more than any other subgroup, you could say, in American society. And there became a very close alliance or alignment between the Democratic Party and African Americans in the 1930s, which continues to today. But yes, by the 1960s, the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act in the mid-60s really do make the Democratic Party the champion of African American civil rights, particularly led by Lyndon Johnson. And so there you get the more modern association of Democrats with liberal policy and groups like African Americans voting for them. And then Republicans, though it's a little unfair, many Republicans did vote for the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act, but the Republican Party over the next few decades becomes the party of largely white working class and middle class voters. And that's where maybe the Christian right comes in as well, as most people in the Christian right, we can call them evangelicals or Catholics or conservatives, but most of them demographically were middle class or working class white Americans.
Did they feel what, disenfranchised by the various acts that the Democrats have been pushing at that point?
There's certainly some truth to that. I think it was Lyndon Johnson who said he'd lost the South when he signed the Civil Rights Act. He'd lost the South for a generation, and so there's definitely a sense that there's some backlash among white Americans to the Civil Rights Act. That's not the only thing going on, though, and particularly if you think about it on the religious angle, there's a lot of social change happening in the '60s that is being processed in different ways among Christians, and then there's major cultural issues like abortion and feminism that are emerging in the '60s and early '70s and are creating new sort of factions or new alliances that ultimately lead to, at least in part, the creation of the Christian right.
Is it a voting bloc at this point, the Christian right?
In the '60s and '70s, it's not. You know, it's actually interesting. There was a lot of talk at the time about the silent majority.
Yes.
Richard Nixon used
yes.
that term. And that would have included a lot of evangelicals. But they weren't at least talked about as a right-wing voting bloc. And up until even the 1976 election, which is Jimmy Carter against Gerald Ford, the evangelical vote, if you want to call it that, was about split 50-50. Part of that was because Jimmy Carter identified as born again, which was this term that was emerging to really identify evangelicals. And so some evangelicals voted for Jimmy Carter because he was one of their own, or at least they thought he was, on politics. But that's all to say that by the mid-70s, there's still an openness or a sense of lack of clarity of where partisan-wise do evangelicals land. And this is the same for Catholics. There are the Christian right is not just evangelicals. There are many conservative Catholics. If you think of our Supreme Court now, it's stalked by a lot of conservative Catholic judges. And that's part of the power of the Christian right is it actually was an alliance between a number of conservative religious groups. It wasn't just evangelicals. And in the 70s, Catholics were not identifiably Republican voters either. In fact, many of them were considered a sort of mainstay of Democratic labor politics. And so that is also emerging in the 70s as a new fault line, is that within the Catholic Church, there becomes a self-identified conservative wing of the American Catholic Church. Some of this also, this gets really complicated, but some of it has to do with Vatican II as well, which is happening in the 60s in reforming the Catholic Church. And there's reactions against that by some conservatives as well, who also tend to be social conservatives and so tend to start seeing themselves as a beleaguered part of the Catholic Church. And they're looking for other conservatives, Christians, Mormons, Jews, these all become part of the Christian right, to sort of rally together and actually
Jews
make a difference.
Part of the Christian right. That's ironic.
Well, some of them were at least fellow travelers, you could say, and it depended on the issue. There were certainly social conservative Jews who socially conservative Jews who wanted to vote for conservative social policies. There was also an interesting alignment on foreign policy. In the 70s, you have the rise of the neoconservatives, which tended to be, at least at the beginning, ex-liberal Jewish intellectuals who had strong views on Israel and other things that ended up aligning with the Christian right. And so there were fellow travelers that were part of this mix. And ultimately, they all became housed under the Republican Party. That was the big tent where they all got together and were actually going to be electorally significant.
Where did the Latin American segment of the population fall?
At this point, so we're talking in the 70s and 80s, it's quite small and it's not politically organized. And this is one of the things that the Christian right brings to evangelicals in the 60s and 70s, is it gives them an organization or sort of a platform on which to exercise their voting power or their lobbying power. For Latin American or Latin evangelicals or Christians, there just weren't enough of them to really organize on that level, and they didn't have some type of lobby group. They do now. There are now sort of Hispanic evangelical lobby groups that end up today landing with a mix of what we call conservative and liberal policies. They tend to be more liberal on economic issues and more conservative on social issues, which is actually a trend among non-white evangelicals. But in the 70s, the big story was that white evangelicals in particular and white conservative Christians were organizing together for the first time and looking past. It might be hard today to remember how much antipathy there were between Protestants and Catholics in even the 1950s and 1960s.
Well, even in 1960 when JFK was elected, that was, oh, he's Catholic, and that gave some people pause.
Yeah, including people like Billy Graham, who became, you know, very important to the evangelical side. And the question for evangelicals was Kennedy or any other Catholic in office, were they ultimately beholden to the Pope?
Right.
I mean, that was the big question. So these were deep antipathies that go back centuries. And one of the remarkable things about the Christian right in the 70s and 80s is that these conservative Christians look past those issues to become what they called co-belligerents on these cultural issues. And so they put aside their theological or church differences and said, we all care about pushing back against feminism or pro-life or pro-Cold War policies, and that became a really powerful way to organize politically for the next few decades.
They were against pro-Cold War policies?
They were pro-Cold War. So the Christian right, particularly if you think of someone like Jerry Falwell, who became a very important leader of what was called the Moral Majority at the time, he was very much about ramping up the Cold War to the levels that had not been seen since the 1950s, and particularly strengthening America's arsenal. That's how he would talk about it. He had interpreted the 60s and 70s as a time where the U.S. had become lax and weak in foreign policy, had fought the Vietnam War to a lot of cost, and détente was the foreign policy followed by Kissinger, which seemingly was about thawing relations between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. People like Falwell thought that this was not the right way to go, that there should be essentially a new Cold War, and that Reagan was the politician to really usher this in. And so there's an idea that we should increase our military budget, we should build more nukes, we should really try to pressure the Soviet Union in a way that hadn't been seen for decades. And that was really, in terms of the early 80s, that was the Christian right's calling card on foreign policy, at least.
Is this because of that catchphrase, godless communism?
Yes. So this was the concern by the Christian right, was that communism had was not an empty threat, that for many Americans, This was an old threat that wasn't nearly as pertinent as other things on the horizon. But for someone like Falwell, he interpreted the whole social revolutions of the 1960s that were overturning ideas of race and gender and sexuality as communist threats, as plots from the communists that you know, youth in particular, young people were sort of consuming communism, cultural Marxism. These were terms that were bandied about at the time. And so this was just the newest form of the communist threat. And so there was a need to sort of re-empower the United States to be clear on its Judeo-Christian history. That was another key term at the time.
Yes, that came up, didn't it?
Yeah, and moral clarity on what the U.S. stood for in the world and also what the U.S. opposed in the world, which was embodied most threateningly by atheistic communism.
So was Jerry Falwell and some of his coterie pro-Vietnam War?
At the time, they were, yeah. So, well, Falwell's an interesting example because he was someone who, up until the mid-70s, actually was vocally anti-political. This is one of the things that historians really spend a lot of time on, trying to figure out how people who in the 60s were actually preaching against joining politics, by the 70s were totally in on politics. So Falwell actually had a famous sermon he gave in 1965 called Ministers and Marchers, where he decried the civil rights movement as mixing religion and politics. And he said, you know, these are black ministers and they're marching on these political causes. That's not what ministers should do. Ministers should just preach the gospel and let politics up to the politicians. Well, you know, he ended up eating his own words or basically ignoring his own words just a decade later when he became very vocally pro-life and then pro-Cold War and ended up attending many marches and actually organizing marches as well. So that being said, Falwell was a supporter of the U.S. military, a strong supporter. And so he supported the Vietnam War. He supported the anti-communism that was driving the U.S. to be in Vietnam in the first place. And he supported other interventions that the U.S. made in the 70s and after Grenada and other places as part of the bigger Cold War project. And he thought the Cold War was really a clarifying moral cause for the U.S., that whatever else was happening domestically and with culture, the U.S. stood for freedom, stood for God, and stood for extending those values to the rest of the world. So he was very much pro any area where the U.S. would frame what they're doing in those terms.
How much influence did he have? You know, we see at the side at one point or another of how many presidents Billy Graham, but we never got the impression that he was lending anything more than some kind of moral support. But Jerry Falwell, you're saying, is really hardcore espousing certain causes.
Yeah, this is another highly debated question, is how influential were people like this? I think they had some influence. I don't want to go so far as to explain American politics through the lens of someone like Jerry Falwell. Falwell would love that, by the way. If we did that, you know, he's passed away, but he would love knowing about that. He would often claim he ran this group called the Moral Majority. So even the name implies he is speaking for the majority of Americans. He would often claim that at minimum he was representing 50 million Americans, and he got this number. From polling that asked people if they were born again or not. And this was a new way of polling people in the 70s and 80s that really helped create the category of evangelical in modern America. But when pollsters asked that, about a third of Americans, a quarter to a third, would say they were born again. And so Falwell claimed all those people as people that he was speaking for whenever he'd weigh in on any social issue. And so he thought he had a lot of influence. And the 1980 election, where Reagan won handily against Carter, the immediate reporting on that election credited Falwell and the Moral Majority for the big win that Reagan had. And so Falwell came into the 80s with a lot of cachet. Most historians now, when they go back and look at the 1980 election, don't think Falwell was the decisive factor. There are many other things going on. That was one factor, but we don't need to put too much weight on it. But at the time, Falwell had a lot of cachet in the culture and in the church world, and he carried that through the 80s. Now, he had some, like many televangelists. He had a lot of scandals at the end of the 80s that meant his credibility collapsed. He remained a very important figure, often attended the White House when a Republican was in office, whether it was Reagan or George H.W. Bush or George W. Bush. But I think you can think of his influence more broadly as being within the Christian world more than within U.S. politics in general. He had a lot of influence when it came to the Republican Party, when it came to, you know, sort of supporting this or that candidate. Never decisive, but he was in the mix. But more broadly, there were plenty of Americans who never listened to a thing Falwell said and really didn't care what he had to say either. And so it's important to put people like this in context and understand where they had power and where they didn't.
We will look further at the phenomenon of evangelism or evangelists and politics in the U.S. when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Dan Hummel, and we're looking at the phenomenon of evangelicals in American politics. And before we go any farther, I mean, I think I have a pretty good idea of what an evangelical is, but this is a little different from what I was thinking originally. So define our term there, Dan.
So evangelical, you can think of it a few different ways. There's a theological definition of evangelicalism that's really about the particular ways evangelicals do their Christian faith or what they believe. And that tends to focus on the idea of a conversion being at the core of what it means to be an evangelical, that everyone's a sinner, and then they have a conversion experience that means that they become a Christian. It's very evangelical. There's also an emphasis on evangelism, on actually spreading the word. This is sometimes in the academic literature called activism. This is how you're supposed to act out your faith. And there's also a really strong emphasis on the Bible, that more than tradition like Catholics might have, more than the church, the thing that is at the root of evangelicals' faith is their personal engagement with the biblical text, and that this is how God speaks to evangelicals. So when it comes to politics, what that means is that evangelicals tend to reason out of the Bible. Whether that's proof texting, which is the idea of just if you have an idea, you just find a verse that sort of supports what you do, or if it's a more authentic engagement with the historical context of the Bible, what the Bible actually teaches. Evangelicals are maybe unique. Most Christians reference the Bible pretty regularly, but evangelicals make that as the baseline of any type of political activities. They need to have verses to support it and a biblical argument for why their politics are the right ones.
But for 2,000 years, well-trained biblical scholars have been debating the meaning of these various translations from the Hebrew and the Greek and the original sources of the Bible. And so how could you even come up with a cohesive evangelical movement with all these possible interpretations of the Bible?
Well, that's where, you know, big trends in history and society and religion come into the mix. But, you know, one thing maybe to emphasize is that evangelicals are Protestants, and they're particularly, you could call them egalitarian Protestants. Often egalitarian is not associated with the Christian right, but the idea is that every Christian has the equal ability to interpret the Bible on their own. This is something God has given each of us, is the ability to reason.
You don't need that intermediary.
You don't need the scholars. You don't need the priests. You just need you and God and the Bible. And so this has created a populism or a way where evangelicals really do grapple with the English language text of the Bible. Most evangelicals don't know Greek or Hebrew, and so they can't actually go back to the sources. That's what scholars would be for. But they do have a commitment that every follower of Jesus has basically an equal say in what the Bible means. And so, of course, some have more influence than others. Pastors tend to have a little more influence than just the average person. But they are not, they tend to not be be held up by the idea that there's been 2,000 years of debate on this. And they bring their own agenda and their own clarity to the text. They also, evangelicals tend to believe that the Holy Spirit is in them and is working with them. And so if they come to a sense that the Holy Spirit has guided them to interpret the Bible in a certain way, that's a very strong piece of evidence for an evangelical that isn't going to be contradicted by an expert or a scholar or a priest.
You use that word egalitarianism. Would that square with an interracial egalitarianism?
In principle, yes. So in theological, this is often why a theological definition of evangelicalism doesn't get you all the way, because in practice, you know, in Galatians, the Apostle Paul says there is neither Greek nor Jew, neither slave nor free, neither man nor woman. And that would imply that there is an egalitarianism that extends to all people across the globe. But in practice, evangelicals have actually been highly demographically bounded. And so evangelicals, at least as we talk about them historically, have tended to be white, have tended to come from, you know, have ancestry in the Anglo-American world. In more recent years, have tended to be middle class, have tended to have certain social views and views about the economy and other things. And so this has been a debate within evangelicalism, sort of are evangelicals living up to their stated theological values, particularly around race, but other issues as well. And often evangelicals have fallen short of that universalistic view of sort of who's in and who's out of the community. Now, in more recent, you say in that last century, but certainly in more recent decades, evangelicals who love evangelizing and spreading the gospel have been very successful across the globe. And this has been a story that has meant that there's evangelicals from basically every country now, people who actually have evangelical theology but are not white Western people. And so that's been a new point of conversation, even tension, is that there's a lot of Latin American evangelicals, a lot of African evangelicals who have much different views on the social issues that white evangelicals in America say are very clear based on the Bible. And there's these other contexts, these other readings of the Bible that say, oh, that's not so clear, particularly on economic issues. And so this has been a point of tension, but it's only a point of tension because of the diversification of the evangelical grouping, you could say, that even 50 years ago, most evangelicals were Western and white, and that's just not the case anymore.
You've mentioned economics a time or two. What do traditional or contemporary evangelicals feel about the way an American economy could run? A lot of it, of course, has to deal with social services and supporting those. And it's a Christian thing, too, that you minister the poor.
Mm-hmm.
But evangelicals stand how on that?
It's a topic for debate. Overall, though, evangelicals have tended to be conservative, you could say, on this issue, libertarian even. Evangelicals, particularly any evangelicals who were born or grew up in the Cold War period, really associated, like many Americans did, anything that smacked of centralized government or socialism as a slippery slope to communism. Mm-hmm. And so many evangelicals, particularly until recently, really just associate free market economics with God's intended, you know, sort of economic system. And that's changed recently, particularly younger evangelicals who grew up after the Cold War ended have a much more mixed view. There's also a lot more economic hardship among younger Americans, and so they're less sort of immediately buying into the economic system as they inherited it. But there was certainly a lot of writing, theology, activism from the 1940s to the even to today that really makes the case that God is a free market person, that he designed humans to be rational actors in the economy, and that any type of centralization of power is against God's wishes. There has been a dissenter tradition that goes back at least to the 1970s. It's often called the evangelical left. It's very small compared to the broader evangelical world. But the evangelical left has been much more aligned with progressive views on economics that has been much more concerned about redistribution of wealth, about social services and other things. So that those are still evangelicals, but they're the minority view. The majority view has been really aligned with Republican Party views on these things going back at least to the 80s.
What does the Bible have to say, Old and New Testament, about the status of women?
Well, it has a lot to say, and this, to go back to your theme, it depends on where you're reading and what you're reading about. And so evangelicals have tended to be, you could call them traditionalist on this view, that the lingo within the community is complementarian, that there are distinct roles for men and women, whether that's in the church or in the family or in society more largely, and that these are very distinct roles. And so any type of social movement that's trying to collapse the differences between men and women is going against the created order. They would point back to Genesis 1 and the creation narrative where God creates Adam and then he creates Eve and he gives them each different roles. And evangelicals would say this is sort of the fabric of the universe, the fabric of creation has these distinct roles for men and women. And so that much of their politics or their views on social issues that relate to gender and sexuality come out of this commitment that they would root back into the biblical narrative starting in Genesis.
So they would be, for example, opposed to women in the military?
They certainly were at the time that has been a hotly debated issue. Some of these things come and go, and evangelicals are, as we've been talking about, biblical conversion-oriented Christians. They're also Americans, and so their views on these things change over time that make them less remarkable on some of these issues than you might think. One really interesting one today is gambling. And so if you go back 100 years, evangelicals were some of the strongest advocates against what they would call urban vices, but gambling being a key one, particularly gambling around sports and other things was seen as like one of the worst ways. You know, think about boxing. This is maybe a Victorian era way of thinking about boxing, but boxing is putting two men in a ring, watching them beat each other up, and then, you know, betting on who is the better. This seems so anti-Christian.
Yeah, two men who would not, outside of the ring, be enemies.
That's right. That's right. So this seemed, for many evangelicals at the time, this was at the core of, like, this was an immoral sport with then gambling happening around it. Today, you don't actually hear many evangelicals speak out against gambling, even though it has become sort of pervasive in our sports culture in the last 5 years. And that's because there isn't because evangelicals are Christians, but they're also Americans. And so they've sort of moved on this issue with many Americans and don't see the moral outrage that their ancestors 100 years ago would as well. So on some of these gender issues or sexuality issues, there are some that are sort of major points of contention in the culture wars. There are other ones that evangelicals have moved on as a community, as American culture has moved. Another one would be women working. You know, this was something that was a big topic of contention in the 1950s or early 1960s. Should women be allowed to work? Does that mean they're superseding their role as mothers in the house? You know, that sort of traditional way of talking about that. Evangelicals today don't tend to talk in those same ways. Some do. There are definitely people that do. But the majority view is not worked up as much about women working outside the home as they would have been 50 years ago.
Well, that changed so much during World War II, didn't it?
It did. And yes, World War II is a major shift, though there was a sort of backlash to that in the 50s and 60s. The economy's changed a lot since the 50s. And so the necessity for women to for families to have two incomes and other things has meant that that has been much less of a driving issue for the Christian right or for evangelicals.
And there's a much broader variety of work.
That's right. That's right. So all these things have changed, meaning that, and this is an insight into how evangelicals would think through this. They return to the biblical texts that sort of talk about where women should work or where men should work, and they continually interpret them through their current cultural lens. And so that means the interpretations change over time. Now, a charitable way to do this or to talk about this is to say, maybe this is what God intended. Maybe this is how Christians are. I mean, Christians shouldn't just be stuck in one moment in time for forever. And so this is an actual authentic way of reasoning and actually having the Bible be a living text that you're working with to develop ethics and views on politics. A more cynical way or a less charitable way would be to say there's a moving target here, and it seems like it just moves based on power politics, on where the money is, on where evangelical leaders want to make a mark. And, you know, the truth is probably right in the middle of all that.
Well, there is such a thing as interpreting any text to mean what's convenient for you.
That's right. And I don't want to go all the way that way because there's unlimited examples. You can think of even about an old example about slavery and the Bible and how there were – I mean, Lincoln talked about this in his second inaugural, that both sides thought God was on their side. And so, yes, there's a way where the Bible can make it say what you want it to say. There tends to be, at least among some evangelicals, a deep desire to actually be formed by the Bible as opposed to just making the Bible do whatever you want it to. Now, when you get to the political leaders of the Christian right, it gets a little harder to see exactly how they're being being faithful to the text when often they are invoking the text in these very thin ways to just make arguments for the policies they want. But in general, the evangelical tradition at its best does acknowledge that, yes, you can make anything mean anything in the Bible, but also there are some things that the Bible is actually saying are right and wrong, and that as Christians we're supposed to try to follow those as best as we can.
I don't recall that the Bible, unless you're kind of interpreting through a couple of layers, has anything to say about abortion. So has that always been a solid issue for evangelicals?
It hasn't. The Bible is silent on mostly on abortion, as we would talk about it today. It does have some texts that seem to talk about God knowing someone in their mother's womb, and so that would imply that there's some type of personhood. And then abortion, of course, fits into a broader set of issues around when you believe life begins and who has the agency to begin or end life.
How do you define that?
And how you even define that, right. And so abortion fits into a bigger set of issues. But no, evangelicals up until the late 60s were not known as, you could say, pro or anti-abortion or pro-life activists. That was actually the Catholic position. Catholics
Sure.
were much more consistent on this through the 20th century. And so it's an interesting story. There's a good historian named Daniel Williams who's written all about the pre-Roe v. Wade pro-life movement that was almost entirely Catholic, and then how that movement ended up basically adding on evangelicals to their ranks, and there's way more evangelicals, and so became an evangelical issue in the 70s. And people like Falwell, who we've talked a bit about, became, as he tells his own story, he became active in politics because of abortion. So he says this was the issue. He has a story about reading the newspaper the day after Roe v. Wade was decided, setting the newspaper down and realizing, you know, this country is leaving its God, the influence of God. I need to get active. And so those types of stories are pretty prominent and become the way that evangelicals talk about their own political involvement, that this is the issue, this idea of life, this idea of protecting children, of fighting back against feminism, as they would call it, and the autonomy of the body that feminism claims women have. Now, the story is much more complicated than that, and many historians have talked about, you know, Roe v. Wade is in 1973. A lot of the activism among people like Falwell is not for another 5 years. 78, 79. And so what were they doing during those 5 years if they were so moved in 1973? And you come to find out that there's actually a lot of issues that are activating evangelicals. Abortion is one of them. Another one of them is desegregation in schools that is, of course, judged to be unconstitutional in the 50s, but is taking a very long time to actually implement throughout, particularly the South. And so there's reactions against that that are creating. Falwell himself created a Christian school that was a way to basically keep a nominally segregated school without calling it a segregated school. And that's happening in the 70s as well. And the IRS is getting interested in these cases and actually pushing down on them. And then we have the backlash to the 60s culture as well. So all these things are happening together in the 70s to create the modern Christian right. And so abortion is in the mix. And it's definitely one of the issues that creates unity across all these differences of Catholic and evangelical or different types of evangelicals. But it's not the only driving issue. And that's part of that is because it wasn't really a strong issue in the 60s, and it only becomes an issue in the 70s.
What sort of an approach or policy do they have toward abortion, though? Because it's a continuum day by day for 9 months.
That's right. Well, before Roe v. Wade, there was a lot of debate actually among evangelicals of what were the question wasn't, is abortion right or not? It's just in what cases is abortion right? And there was often in cases of rape or incest, abortion was okay, or if the mother was in grave danger, that abortion was okay. This was actually like major evangelical magazines would talk about this in the 60s.
Pretty standard set of criteria.
Right. Even across all Protestants, like it wasn't even unique to evangelicals. Once abortion becomes an issue, the key that evangelicals want to see happen is abortion being outlawed at the sort of federal level, a reversal of Roe v. Wade. And that becomes their defining way of fighting this issue. It's not about that. There were other ways you could have fought against abortion. You could have created a whole network of social support organizations that helped women sort of think through these things. And that's what a lot of Catholics did. And some evangelicals did that as well. But the primary way evangelicals wanted to fight against Roe v. Wade was to overturn it. And so that would be, for some of them, outlawing abortion entirely, saying it is, there's no case where abortion is legal. Most evangelicals had some position that was in the middle that had some exceptions for extreme circumstances. But of course, those people aren't the ones that are actually driving the movement. The people that are driving the movement are the true believers, the ones who have the most radical views on these things. And so so evangelical abortion politics became, in some, at least in the media, defined by its most extreme proponents, including examples like in the 80s and 90s of Operation Rescue, which actually, you know, protested outside of abortion clinics and even in a few cases committed violence against those abortion clinics. This becomes sort of the public face of the anti-abortion movement, even as most evangelicals, like most Americans, were sort of uncomfortable with a full legality of abortion, thinking that there has to be some limits to this, and yet not wanting to have a full illegality of abortion either, recognizing either that family they knew had gone through an abortion or that there were these extreme cases where it seemed like the just thing to do was not to force a woman to have a pregnancy. But a lot of this opacity or vagueness comes out of the fact that the Bible doesn't have like a clear rule on this. And so you're having to reason from sort of circumstantial evidence and through the ethics that you're inheriting outside of the Bible to get to a position.
Let's look at some specific individuals who are part of this phenomenon, both political and religious, when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with my guest, Dan Hummel, and we're looking at the role of evangelicals in American politics. There's a lot to cover, and we're going to just kind of do this almost as flashcards now, Dan. We're talking about individuals and their role in politics as evangelicals. We already mentioned Jerry Falwell, but another we haven't talked about, Pat Robertson.
Right. So Pat Robertson was so of the same generation as Falwell, so grew up in the 50s and 60s. What Robertson did uniquely was, one, he ran for president in 1988 and didn't make it very far, but really lifted his profile that year. Robertson is probably best known as the host of the 700 Club, which is a TV show that
televangelism
was televangelism, but mixed with a talk show, so he could weigh in on daily events and really weigh in on political events and social events as well. Robertson is someone who had this platform as a media personality, but he was also someone who was really interested in organizing politically evangelicals on the ground. And so in the we talked a bit about the Moral Majority, which is this organization that Falwell founded. It really falls apart by the end of the 80s. And Robertson comes in the 90s and creates what's called the Christian Coalition. And the Christian Coalition is a sort of political grassroots advocacy organization. It did a lot of work for the 1994 Republican takeover of Congress, which was a very momentous event because it was the first time in 50 years that the Republicans had been in charge of the House. And part of the credit goes to the Christian Coalition on that front. And so Robertson was influential there. He was someone who was friends with a lot of Republican politicians, senators, presidential hopefuls, and ultimately became known as someone who also weighed in very controversial ways on a lot of topics. So I study U.S.-Israel relations and Christian Zionism. Robertson had a lot of comments that many perceived as anti-Semitic, even as he was very pro-Israel. Robertson and Jerry Falwell had a very infamous conversation right after 9/11, where they on the 700 Club, I believe, where they blamed 9/11 not on the terrorists, but on the culture wars issues in the U.S. That it was abortion and LGBTQ communities and others that were really at fault because God was judging the United States. They walked that back very quickly. This was literally like September 12th or 13th when they said this. But it was an insight into how Robertson sees the world and sort of how he's interpreting what's happening. But he's of a type. So there are many people, Falwell, Robertson, John Hagee is another one who's very prominent in the pro-Israel world, who all basically created media platforms for themselves that they then leveraged into the political sphere. So that's a whole type of Christian right leader, you could say, is the pastor who becomes a media figure who then starts weighing in on political issues in a way that actually politicians have to take notice of because they're constituency, their audience for their media is so large that it could actually affect votes.
Well, we all know how powerful the media are and have become. Ralph Reed.
So Ralph Reed was closely affiliated with Pat Robertson. He was basically mentored by Robertson. But Reed was not a pastor. He was not a preacher. He was rarely on TV, at least as the main figure. He was a political organizer. He was someone who came in to run the Christian Coalition. Robertson didn't really know what he was doing on that front. He knew to create an organization. He didn't know how to run it. And so Ralph Reed became one of the leaders of a new type of, you could say, evangelical leader, which is the Washington, D.C., the Beltway evangelical evangelical, someone whose entire credibility, his entire authority within evangelical circles was about how he could get political things done and how he could talk about values that evangelicals held in Washington terms. And so he's part of another person in that mode is Karl Rove, who became very famous as a campaign advisor or leader for George W. Bush. But these are people who you just think traditionally evangelicals tend to listen to pastors or people who know their Bible really well and have some type of religious base for their authority. Someone like Ralph Reed doesn't really have that. He has political influence that connects to evangelical values, but isn't actually coming out of credentialing from the evangelical world. And so this is a whole class of people now who are very vested in the Christian right. They're vested in the organizations that make up the Christian right, but they tend not to come out of the evangelical world as such. They might have grown up in it as a kid, but they don't come out of the seminaries or the churches that we would associate with someone like Falwell or even Robertson, who come out of particular denominations with particular roles as pastors. And that's just not where someone like Ralph Reed comes from. And he represents a much bigger group of people like that today.
Glenn Beck.
So Glenn Beck's an interesting one because he is not an evangelical. He's a Mormon, an interesting Mormon with a lot of varied views on things. But he got a lot of popularity in the 2000s and 2010s because he was on Fox News, because he spoke about the Obama administration in particular in ways that resonated with evangelicals, very conspiratorial, very suspicious of Obama. And he leveraged that into a career speaking on the right, but speaking to evangelicals, but not as an evangelical. And so there are a number of these types of media figures who don't come out of the evangelical world, but end up becoming very influential in shaping evangelical attitudes on things because they know how to talk in this value-centric way about government and about family values and other things. And Glenn Beck is maybe one of the better examples of that, in the sense that I think many evangelicals assume Glenn Beck is an evangelical. He certainly doesn't disabuse people of that notion. But in fact, he's a Mormon. He also has a very interesting history of alcoholism and other things in his own life.
As a Mormon, that would be unusual.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, he's an interesting person in his own right. But for our purposes here, he's what shows that the Christian right is broader than just the evangelical right. And that there are ways, particularly when the common currency among all these groups is a certain way of talking about the Democrats, a certain way of talking about liberalism and values. If that's the common currency, then evangelicals are just one group that can talk that way. And others can get in on it as well and really shape the broader Christian rights agenda and identity.
Speaking of media figures and the Christian right, what's Donald Trump's relationship with it?
So Trump, up until 2015, when he starts running for president, was not a huge figure on the Christian right. As you can imagine, I mean, in terms of personal piety, Trump represents almost everything that the Christian right had been railing against, including running casinos, to get back to our gambling conversation. And so Trump was someone who during the Obama era really pushed the birtherism view, which is something that many evangelicals bought into as well. And so there was this common currency of anti-Democrat, anti-Obama that Trump had. But Trump was not, even in the 2015, 2016 primaries, Trump was not the overwhelming preference for evangelicals. They had other candidates, people like Ted Cruz, who came out of the evangelical world that were at least at one point more popular than Trump. But once Trump becomes the Republican nominee, evangelicals fall in line, at least the Christian right leaders fall in line pretty quickly behind Trump. Some of them even claim he is born again, newly born again. James Dobson, who's one of these figures that's always around the Christian right, called Trump a baby Christian during the campaign to sort of give him credibility among evangelicals. And this was an attempt to basically, it was an argument to evangelicals to say, look past all of the surface level problems that you might have with someone like Trump, his multiple marriages, his casino running, his foul mouth, all that kind of stuff. And to say underlying that is a power politics game here, And there's really only – there's a zero-sum game. Either the Democrats win or the Republicans win. We're on the Republican side. We've been on the Republican side for decades. I'm channeling someone like James Dobson here. And so really the question is not to evaluate Trump on his own morals. It's to compare him to what a Democratic administration would do, and in this case Hillary Clinton's administration, and to say which one would you rather have, which one makes Christians more free, more flourishing. And so they threw their weight decisively behind Trump. And part of this was a calculation about the Supreme Court, to get back to the abortion concern that is very
well-defined dominant. Defined issue, yeah.
Yeah, on this issue. If the goal is to overturn Roe v. Wade, well, the only way that's going to happen is if enough justices on the Supreme Court want to overturn it. The only way those types of justices are going to get appointed is if a Republican is in office. And so this was part of the overt, explicit appeal that Trump was making to evangelicals, was vote for me, I will get the right people on the Supreme Court. And for many evangelicals who had deep concerns about Trump, and there were many, on an individual level, even on sort of what type of policies outside of these culture war issues he would pursue, the appeal of abortion as an issue and the appeal of having a Republican appoint Supreme Court justices really did influence a lot of on-the-fence evangelicals to vote for Trump.
Not voting for the man so much as voting for the team, which is what you hear the Biden supporters say sometimes too.
That's right.
In the 2024 election. The Christian right, is it on the ascent or on the descent?
Yeah. Well, just to get back to your last point about Democrats can sound this way as well. I mean, one of the bigger trends here is there's a polarization of our politics. That means tribalism is the way that most Americans are filtering through politics. And this gets to the question of the ascent or descent of the Christian right. Demographically, it's on the decline. So demographically, white, middle-class, conservative Christians are not a growing demographic in our society. We're pluralizing, we're diversifying. And so in terms of numbers, the future looks dim for the Christian right if it stays what it is right now. That being said, within the Republican Party, it is one of the dominant factions in the Republican Party who gets to decide who basically runs for office. In certain states in particular, the Christian right is very powerful in the South and a few other states. And so it continues to be very influential, even as the numbers and even many of its leaders have fallen into discredit for various scandals or other things. There is still a strong group of Christian right evangelicals who vote dependably for the Republican Party, meaning Republicans of any stripe have to take notice of them. And they have a leadership class that is very resilient to the changing winds in Washington. And so someone like Ralph Reed has been around for 20, 30 years at this point and looks to be going nowhere for the next 20 years. And so if you have people like that representing a movement, it's going to have influence. It also has a pretty strong support base in terms of finances in American politics. And so if there's money and there's some votes and there's some activists in Washington who are on your side, you're going to be around. And because Trump relied so heavily on evangelicals in 2016 and 2020 in his campaigns, he's going to rely on them again pretty strongly in 2024. So in the immediate, like this year, evangelicals are going to be another really important player, and the Christian right in general, to decide our election here in 2024.
They would need presumably some kind of allied bloc if they were going to carry much further, though, by what you're saying.
Yeah, so the coalition that elects Trump in 2024, if it were to come about, would be a very interesting coalition that would actually include a lot more votes from the African-American and Latino communities as well. This is one of the trends that a lot of people are talking about this year, is that at least in polling, it seems like Trump is doing much better. And so in a weird way, for many of us who see Trump as someone who is speaking in a way that is sort of alienating non-white voters, Trump might actually come in with one of the most, if he wins the election, with one of the most diverse electorates of any Republican in recent memory. But at the base of that will be the Christian right as well, because they are consistent, they know how to get votes out, and they are well entrenched in Washington, D.C. at this point in 2024.
Dan Hummel, very interesting, very informative, and it's going to be interesting to see how it all plays out.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I'm Norman Gilliland. Our engineer is Tom Blaine, and I hope you'll join me next time around for University of the Air.